Dying for the Story.
I profiled 7 journalists in my book. Every single one of them had predicted their deaths and yet persisted in their story and were killed.
That's investigative journalist Terry Gould. We'll talk about his book, Marked for Death. It explores the stories of journalists killed in the line of duty.
More is not better, and what often happens in the battle for more is that what falls by the wayside is the source of genuine happiness, which is relationships with each other.
And that's Wanda Urbanska of the TV show Simple Living. She'll tell us about how we can downshift our lives for a higher quality with less quantity. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. At least 32 journalists have already been killed in 2009 while reporting on dangerous stories in dangerous places. Since 1992, 758 journalists have been killed on the job. You might be surprised to learn that most of them, 85%, were not foreigners working in country as war correspondents. Instead, they were local journalists exposing official corruption in their own communities. My guest, Terry Gould, says those communities are most often in countries where corruption is embedded in the formal structure of government. Lawlessness takes place within the law, and the system of organized crime is locked into the business of the nation. Places like Russia, Colombia, the Philippines, and Bangladesh. Places where journalists are murdered with impunity, and 95% of the people who ordered their murders remain unpunished. The 7 journalists Gould profiles in his new book, Marked for Death, knew they would be killed, yet they persisted. More than that, they were willing to give their lives defending the people where they lived against the powers that preyed on them. Gould wanted to know why. What made these journalists tick? What drove them to persist in their investigations, even though they knew they were going to be killed? People like Anna Politkovskaya of Russia. She was murdered the very day Gould was on his way to interview her about the murder of 2 other Russian journalists. Gould has been following organized crime throughout his long career as an investigative journalist. I asked him how he got onto this story.
I first ran into this story of journalists being murdered almost weekly in the Philippines. I was working on a book. I was following a trail of a triad boss who'd staged his own death in the Philippines in order to escape a 20-year jail sentence in Canada. And I was in now the Philippines between 2000 and 2003. And while I was there, 14 Filipino journalists had been murdered, and none of the masterminds of the people who had killed them were punished for it. And the local press freedom group staged protests and said more would be killed unless somebody was arrested. Nobody was arrested. In 2004, another 8 journalists were killed. The following year, on Press Freedom Day 2005, in May, the Committee to Protect Journalists issued a report called Marked for Death, and in which they listed the 5 most murderous countries in the world for journalists. And in order of most killed, they were the Philippines, Iraq, Colombia, Bangladesh, and Russia. A lot of these journalists were clean, when a lot of the overall journalists were. Some would take bribes and some would extort money from their targets. A lot of them lived in small towns and remote areas. And while they'd been targeted beforehand, they persisted in their story, knowing they would almost certainly be killed for doing so. And I wondered who these amazing people were. And since there was so little, even on the internet, to find out who the heck they were, I picked representative cases in these 5 countries in order to tell their full lives, birth to death, to find out what it was about their psychology of sacrifice that made them think that they would accept death as a consequence of their work and go all the way to the point where, in fact, they would be killed for their story. In other words, they weren't acting brave out of some notion that they would wind up on Oprah telling, or Larry King telling how brave they were, they knew they'd be killed. They kept at their work, and they were killed, giving up all notion of personal advancement in order to advance the story they were working on. It was truly amazing, and I wanted to find out in their hearts what it was that made them different than the rest of us.
Let's start with maybe the most famous of those, and that's Anna Politkovskaya. She was a Russian reporter who reported on the Chechen conflict. She had withstood several assassination attempts before finally she was killed. And she talked about, she said at a certain point that the cruelty of the Chechen war was worth a life. You say at a certain point in the book that she wasn't just willing to risk her life, she was willing to give her life.
I'll tell you something else. I profiled seven journalists in my book. Every single one of them had predicted their deaths and yet persisted in their story and were killed. And Politkovskaya was one of those journalists. Now, I had set up to interview Politkovskaya through the email. I was supposed to interview her on October 9th, 2006, to find out from her what it took for two other journalists I was writing about in Russia to stay on a story, even though they knew they would be killed. And I arrived in Russia on the evening of October 7th, 2006. And when I got out of the airport, I made a call to the Committee to Protect Journalists to tell them I'd arrived, and they told me, "You're too late. She was killed today." Yeah. Shot in her apartment house. So she became one of the people I studied. And I found out certain commonalities, as with Politkovskaya, that all these different journalists, even though they're in different countries, spoke different languages, they did have certain commonalities, and Politkovskaya was one of them. And the first commonality I found amongst all these different men and women was that they each had a transformational event in their lives that caused an emotional ache that tore at their hearts early in their career. Something had happened to them, or they had done something to others, that through guilt, revelation, or grief, convinced them that the powerful had to be prevented from oppressing the weak at all costs. And the second commonality was that their towns were dominated by powerful people who believed the weak offered opportunities for the enrichment of the powerful. And the third was that they didn't arrive from somewhere else to expose evildoers in their corrupt and violent lands. They lived where they died, and they tried to defend the people where they lived. Now, when I examined Politkovskaya's life, I found that she had been raised as an elite child to elite people in the Soviet Union. Her parents had been United Nations diplomats, and in fact she was born in New York City and had dual citizenship. She came back to Russia as a young child, and she grew up going to the best schools and became a journalist. And after Glasnost, her reporting tended to reflect her elite upbringing. She concentrated on profiling the cultural elite and the intelligentsia. Even as the first Chechen War was taking place between 1994 and 1996, her transformational moment came at the end of the first Chechen War. She went to a refugee center. She wanted to do a story about big-eyed Chechen children. And she walked into the refugee center and swooshed in her high society clothes and very good looks. Looks and fashion were very important to her at that time. And lining the walls of this refugee center were 100 people who had just emerged from Grozny after an aerial bombardment by Yeltsin, who was negotiating to end the war. And she saw young people begging for their parents who had just been killed, husbands crying because their wives had just been killed, old people who were wounded. Everyone had suffered some horrible trauma, and she stopped in her tracks, and she said to herself, what have I been doing with my journalism? In Russia's name, look what we, the Russian people, have done. And that was her epiphany. She had a catharsis of shame, both for herself and for all of Russians. And from that moment forward, till 10 years later, she lived in order to expose that that Chechen story and what the Russians were doing to Chechens. And when the second Chechen war began in 1999, she was down there like a shot. She went there 48 times exposing the atrocities committed by the Russian army in the name of the Russian people, moved amongst the warlords who Vladimir Putin had appointed, moved amongst the generals and the soldiers, even as they were committing atrocities, was arrested, beaten, suffered a mock execution, tortured, and she was poisoned once, and yet she continued on that story, even though she would be killed eventually for doing it. And her story is fairly typical in terms of its transformative moment that changed her life completely, and in terms of the death threat she got, the assassination attempts, the prediction of death, and then her own death.
Tell us what she found when she went to Grozny. I mean, you quote her in this book. There she was fleeing out of the city. Give us a brief picture, because we have a lot of ground to cover here, but just give us a brief picture of what she found. What are the conditions there? And even, why is Russia involved?
That question about why Russia is involved deals with Russian history in general. If you look at Russia, you'll see that it's this huge country that under the Soviet Union had all these provinces on its periphery. And during the days of the Tsars, they expanded Russia in all directions. And one of the places they expanded was south into the Caucasus. And they conquered what was in the 1840s an independent state called Chechnya. It was a Islamic state, a Muslim state. And the people were never very happy under there, and they were always restive. And after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, they declared independence. And two wars were fought to keep them within Russia, the new state of Russia. The second war was the one that Politkovskaya became most famous for covering. And in order to quell the rebellion in Chechnya, Putin ordered the Russian army into the country in force, and they fought block by block in every town and used very brutal means to suppress the rebellion. They would establish camps, and they dug pits, and they threw rebels into the pits that were 6 feet deep with slats over the top, and they kept hundreds of them. They'd take them out. They raped them occasionally, and they would come into towns and conduct mop-up operations and line young rebels up against the wall and shoot them. So it really was a very, very dirty war. And Politkovskaya really suffered on behalf of all of Russian people what was being done in the name of Russians. Now, at the very beginning of the war, what she encountered when she had first arrived in Grozny and left, as she was fleeing, she discovered that as the Russians were fighting block to block to retake Grozny, they had isolated this old age home where about several hundred mentally deficient and infirm people were without food and water, and there was no way to get help to them. So she contacted a local reporter at her newspaper, Novaya Gazeta. And they went down there, and through her heroic action on the battlefront, risking death herself, managed to save those infirm people at the old age home. And nobody thought she could do it. Even the military correspondent, who was a veteran Russian army officer, even he thought she was crazy for trying it. And she was able to do it. And don't forget, as she was doing all these heroic deeds, at her own newspaper in Moscow, Novaya Gazeta, journalists were being murdered for their own investigative reporting. One was murdered in 2000, another was murdered in 2003, and at the funeral of the second, she stood at the casket with a colleague, and she said to a friend, "I will be next." And indeed, she was next, several years later. And since then, yet another Russian journalist has been killed. So there's one newspaper, four Russian journalists have been murdered.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with investigative journalist Terry Gould about his book, Marked for Death, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It's about journalists who've been killed on the job because of their investigations. You say that Anna Politkovskaya was actually not that easy a person to get along with. And in some ways, you also connect that. I mean, that's part of this nuanced picture of her heroism. Could you talk about how her personality, her character, you know, fed into her willingness to do this?
Yeah. None of the journalists, of the seven journalists I wrote about, except for one, six of them were not saints. They were fallible people. They had foibles and unusual parts of their personality that came about as a result is that they were so extraordinary. If you're going to accept death as a consequence of your work, you're going to be a different kind of person from the start. You're driven in a way that normal people who have sort of the normal hesitancies about risking your life have. So she was extremely forceful. She was intolerant of people that did not recognize the emergency situation that was going on day to day to the south. So she called what the normal frame of Russian mind a bacchanalia of indifference. And when people at her newspaper tried to give some nuance to the Chechen war, that, you know, there was a Chechen mafia, that Chechens had a history of violence, and that it might be difficult for them to run an independent nation, she would blow up at them. And she had numerous, endless conflicts with everybody at her newspaper. As told to me, she was an insufferable colleague. They all recognized that she was an extraordinary human being. But she's no different from many of the other journalists I worked at. And I would put it this way. Everybody loves the idea of Davy Crockett, but no one will ever hire him because he overturns everything in the office. Mm-hmm. In Colombia, I wrote about a guy by the name of Guillermo Bravo Vega. Now, Bravo had won the Colombian equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize, the Simon Bolivar Award. So he was one of the best journalists in Colombia. But every time he would go to work at a newspaper or some other venue, right away he would see that the advertisers were getting special treatment, and he started investigating the advertisers of the newspaper or the TV station. And he would have a huge blow-up in the lineup room, and people would say, what are you doing? You're ruining our paper. And he says, you guys are talking with your mouths full, which is a Colombian expression, meaning you're taking money in order to leave the bad guys alone. So he was fired or he quit every single newspaper he worked for, and he eventually started his own magazine and TV station in this little town that was surrounded by guerrillas and controlled by paramilitaries and run by a local political force called the Opitas Mafia, and he would write about the economy. So all these stories have a lot of similarities. They were very different people, and how they got to the end point is very different, but they all had that same irascible nature that made them very obdurate in the face of people that were not fired by the thought that the whole town had to be upended in order for justice to be done. They were like tornadoes trying to turn the town upside down, or they thought it was right side up.
He's a really marvelous example, Guillermo Bravo Vega. And tell us a little bit more about him, and actually tell us how he got started in all this. I mean, whereas for Anna Politkovskaya, it was her revelation when she saw the Chechen refugees in Moscow. Yeah. For him, it was something entirely different.
Yes. Guillermo Bravo Vega was born in 1938 to a plantation coffee picker who lived in a hovel. And the plantation owner had a habit of seducing the teenage pickers on the plantation and siring their offspring. So Bravo was born the illegitimate son of the plantation owner, but lived with his mother in this hovel. And this woman had done something to either get the plantation owner angry or jealous, or maybe she demanded support. But in any case, she wound up being poisoned to death, as her own mother had been poisoned to death by a previous plantation owner. And it's told to me by the local journalist there, they believe that the plantation owner had had Bravo's mother put away. So Bravo was on his own, living in this hovel in the midst of a civil war. This happened when he was about 12 or so. And there was a civil war going on back then called La Violencia. So the plantation owner took him in, took Guillermo Bravo in, and raised him as a member of the elite upper class. So for the next 10 years, Bravo considered himself as part of the conservative upper class. And he wound up getting a job, his father wound up getting him a job with the police. And when he was 23 years old, he got drunk with the police, and he walked into a bar with them, and they went to use the toilet. They said, here's a gun to protect yourself. And he got into some kind of discussion with a workman who was sitting at one of the tables, and the workman made a pun on his name and said, if you're so brave, man, shoot me. So Bravo picked up the gun and shot him between the eyes and killed him. And he had the opportunity to have that crime fixed. He could have got off, but he was so horrified at what he had done and came up with such a sudden realization of his true roots, the daughter of a plantation picker who had been raised to be in the elite establishment, that he said, I am going to make up for this for the rest of my life. And he pled guilty, even though he didn't have to. And he went to jail for 5 years, and he talked to socialists and trade unionists. And suddenly he became a leftist. He said, I'm going to change Colombia. And when he got out of jail 5 years later, he was pardoned by the government because he'd become a leftist, and that leftist government had taken power. He began his studies to become an economist, and he tried to revamp the coffee industry so that more money would be distributed to the poor pickers. And then he said the next step is to become a journalist. And he wrote an article about a way to revamp the entire coffee industry called Bonanza, the rise and fall of the economy, and that won him the Simon Bolivar Prize, which is the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize. And then he said, and he was 40 years, 41, 42 at the time, he said, okay, now I'm going to go back to my hometown of Neiva, and I'm going to try and straighten that town out. So he went through this catharsis and this epiphany after he'd murdered somebody, and that changed him for the rest of his life. And for the next 20 years or so, he fought to change Neiva, which was run by this hereditary clan of people called the Opitas Mafia, from the governor on down. The economy was in a vice grip of corruption. And he published a magazine called Eco Impacto, which meant the echoing impact of the economy. And he basically audited and monitored the corrupt local government. He survived numerous assassination attempts, and he was ordered to get out of town six times.
And he actually, when he was killed, it's almost as if he knew very well that he was being killed. He almost... He opened the door to his executioners.
The seventh time he was ordered to get out of town, he had contacts amongst some of the paramilitaries. Well, he had an undercover agent working inside there, and they told him, yeah, they're going to get you. So he told his colleagues, this time they're going to get me. And for the first time in his life, he fled to Bogota. He was so certain that they were going to kill him that he actually fled. But he stayed away only 2 weeks, and then he went back to his town of Neiva, and he started his old aggressive reporting on the local Opitas Mafia. But by then he was in despair. He said, I've been planting in the desert for so many years, and 6 years I'll be 70 years old, and I'll still be fighting against these forces. And he started working on a documentary film about left-wing people that had been murdered by paramilitaries in the right-wing government. And when he came home, he would work at night in a little cubbyhole office that was right by the door. And his common law wife at the time would keep the door locked, but when she went out to work at her night job, she would see him always. As soon as she was leaving the house, he would get up and open the door so that he would sit at his desk, lit and framed as if in a picture. Even though he knew and had been warned by a paramilitary that he was going to get killed if he came back to town and started work again, he presented himself as a target. And sure enough, they walked in right off the street, and they shot him in the heart, in the mouth, and in the forehead, as if to send a message to everyone else, don't feel this way, don't talk this way, don't think this way. And in every one of these cases, when they kill them, they send a message like this.
Terry Gould. His book, Marked for Death, takes its title from a report by the Committee to Protect Journalists, a New York-based organization that keeps track of press freedom abuses around the world. It also lobbies on behalf of threatened journalists. We'll talk more with Gould after the break.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
You're listening to WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Terry Gould about his book, Marked for Death, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It profiles the inner lives of seven journalists who investigated corruption in their own countries and knew they would be killed for it. So moving on from Guillermo Bravo Vega, and I have to say, it's a marvelous portrait of this man, as it is of all of the people that you profile in the book. I think the one that I was most moved by, however, is the one that you said, you know, was the exception to the rule that none of them were saints. This was Manik Chandrasaha. This man was actually revered as a saint in his native Bangladesh. I'd like you to start first, though, talking about his country, because I had no idea that Bangladesh was so corrupt. Tell us a little bit about, you know, about Bangladesh, about the Godfathers, and how that society is organized.
Well, consistently, since Transparency International has been listing their corruption index, which is basically all 188 countries in the world, Bangladesh is scored near the bottom. Sometimes it comes up a little bit, then it drops down the bottom again. And it used to be a part of the British Empire, and then after 1949, India was formed as an independent nation with West Pakistan and East Pakistan on its flanks, and Bangladesh was East Pakistan. And then in 1971, East Pakistan won its independence from West Pakistan and became Bangladesh. And the British Governor General at the time said that it will be the greatest rural slum in history. It had no resources. It was mostly all flat. It was prone to natural disasters. And the political situation reflected the natural disasters. You had one revolution after another, numerous assassinations. And because the central authority was so weak, in the remote provinces, Bengal Mafia-type politicians took power, and they were called godfathers. And Manik Saha lived in the very remotest southwest quadrant of the country called Khulna, which was cut off from the capital by two huge rivers and bordered on the south by the last remnant of the Bengal rainforest called the Sundarbans. And Manik Saha wrote for a newspaper in the capital, and he would expose all the mafia doings and the strange alliances, the bizarre. Nowhere else in the world have I ever encountered forces aligned so oxymoronically. So you had the ruling caste of the seven godfathers who controlled the Chamber of Commerce and the mayor's office and the city council and the district councils align themselves with the local jihadists and with the Maoist rebels. They would hire these guys to illegally log the Sundarbans, to steal rice land from Hindu farmers and murder the farmers and rape the farmers' wives. And Manik Saha would travel on his own in these remote Jigsaw Islands and up rivers and down tidal creeks in order to document the atrocities that were taking place to benefit these seven godfathers through their arms of the jihadists and the Maoist rebels. In other words, crime made these people brothers, even though they were on totally opposite sides of the political spectrum. And journalist after journalist who had gone near these subjects were murdered. And Manik Saha himself said, "Any time I can be killed." But he was a unique man in that his kindness, his inner goodness were clearly recognized. I began the book with an epigraph from Vaclav Havel. The epigraph is, "I am not interested in why man commits evil. I want to know why he does good." I had written about international organized crime for 20 years before I started this book. And I had written about why people committed evil, and now I wanted to write about why they did good. These seven journalists explained that to me, but the one who truly presented me with a portrait of goodness was Manik Chandra Saha.
And tell us why. I mean, tell us about his childhood and how that influenced who he became.
Yeah, with him, I found something that was the most difficult to explain. It was selflessness that came from pure goodness. So, as with the others, the other journalists I wrote about, I searched back, starting from his murder, trying to go back to find out what was his cathartic moment. What was the time when he had become so driven with this notion that he had to upend the evil structure in his community? And what I discovered was that he had lost his mother when he was about 9 years old, and he was bereft. He loved his mother deeply, and he was given over to be brought up by his aunt, and he was inconsolable. And his aunt told him, "Manik, the more you think about yourself, the unhappier you are. Why don't you set up a little school under a banyan tree and teach the little kids in the village how to read?" And he did that. And he realized something. This is at 9 years old. He realized that by doing good for others, he felt better about himself. And that stuck with him for the rest of his life. 10 years later, he took a trip by himself into the Sundarbans, this wilderness area that's sort of the last refuge of the rainforest in Bangladesh. And he had an atheistic revelation. And the revelation was that natural selection had chosen a law of goodness. And for evidence of that, he said, if you look around at the world, you find that most people are good, and they knew that and know they should behave good, that there's a very small minority of people that are really bad, and that acting good made him feel good. So he truly believed in a scientific principle that there was a law of goodness, and that you would know how to behave in all situations if you just were good to other people. He saw goodness in all people, but that goodness was hidden until those people acted good. Then it was self-evident. So for the rest of his life, he had a scientific way to behave in all situations. And he put it to work as a humanitarian as well as a journalist. He founded schools and libraries and cultural organizations and rural poverty councils, human rights committees, women's shelters, medical clinics. He started a theater group, a music academy, a foundation for working children, and this international action forum to save the Sundarbans, which in fact got the Sundarbans listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and is the reason even today, with millions of people pressing it from every side and all kinds of forces trying to destroy it, it's still there as the last refuge of the Bengal tiger and the Sundari tree, which the godfathers had been logging. So he did a lot of good in his life, and he was recognized for doing a lot of good. At the same time, he was exposing the most dangerous people in South Asia. And they finally caught up with him, but they caught up with him in a manner that sent a message to all the other journalists. They fashioned a tiny bomb about the size of your fist, stuffed with gunpowder and with a detonator on it. And he was coming out of the press club. They got up really close to him, and they threw that little bomb at his head. So it exploded his head, decapitated him, right near the press club. So his brains blew up right in the street. And when the journalists poured out onto the street, they saw the message to them. We've taken off that. He had been the president of the press club one time, and the message was, we've taken off your head. Who's next?
His funeral was a national day of mourning, nonetheless. Talk about that. Talk about the love that people had for him. And I found it ironic, too, because it seemed that with all the power that these evil men have, he had gotten his message of good far and wide.
Everyone in the district where he lived had been touched by the work of Manik Saha, because he traveled constantly in the most dangerous areas, down all these remote tidal creeks and up into these little towns where the jihadists were raping Hindu farm wives and where the godfathers were stealing land. So everyone in the district, even if they were illiterate, knew of this saint-like journalist named Manik Saha, who is making their plight public. And when he died, it was almost like Mahatma Gandhi had died. Throughout the district, through cell phone and word of mouth and radio, the word went forth, Manik Saha is dead. And every village poured into its central square, and the women, the Muslim women, broke trinkets. It's a ritual of mourning, and the Hindu women wailed. And in the town of Khulna, where he lived, a million people poured into the streets. And at his funeral, they followed behind his funeral van, and it was truly as if a recognized saint had been killed. And it was amazing for that part of the region, which is so remote and so many isolated pockets, became instantly aware that the one man who had stood up for them had been assassinated.
You went to visit his aunt as you were doing this book. I found that a very moving moment. You asked her why he was so good. She gave you an answer, but you continued to press her. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was really interested, since I found out that Manik had believed in this law of goodness, I was really interested to find out what the source of it was. So I kept pressing her in this very, very remote village. Where did Manik Saha get his goodness? She said, well, I tried to teach him. I said, okay, well, then where did you get your goodness? And she said, well, I got it from my father. And I said, well, where did your father get his goodness? And at that point, she realized, I understand. And so she raised her hand. She's 100 years old. She had a very high voice. And she raised her hands up, and she pointed to the sky. And almost as if she was singing, she said, well, in many people, goodness is hidden because they did not give it. But in Manik, goodness was not hidden because he gave it. That this goodness comes down to all of us equally, but that if you give it, it's self-evident. If you don't give it, it's still in you, but it's hidden. So she was saying that this Saint Manik Saha possessed the same thing that everybody possesses, even if they're evil. But that totality, that potential of sainthood and goodness is still inside each equally because it comes down equally. Now, she was a religious person. She believed that that was a transmission from God. Manik Saha believed it was a transmission from a Darwinian law that made all people equal possessors of this goodness inside them. Otherwise, society could not function, was his feeling. So that the more we gave, the better society would function. So we have two different ways of looking at where that goodness comes from, but the effect is the same on the human race.
Well, Terry Gould, your book is Marked for Death, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. You talk about journalism as an act of courage. This is a marvelous book to read, and thank you so much for sharing your insights with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me, Francesca. I appreciate it.
investigative journalist Terry Gould. He's also the author of Paper Fan, The Hunt for Triad Gangster Stephen Wong, as well as other books and numerous articles. He's earned awards from the Canadian Association of Journalists, Canadian Journalists for Free Expression, and others. Next up, we talk about how less is really more. What makes us happy? The question is answered by a host of writers in a new book co-edited by my guest Wanda Urbanska. She says genuine happiness comes from having more time and downshifting to a lower consumption, more satisfying lifestyle. The book she co-edited, Less is More, counts among its contributors Bill McKibben, author of Deep Economy, as well as many other books, Ernst Kallenbach, who wrote the 1970s classic Ecotopia, and Juliet Shore, author of The Overworked American and its sequel, The Overspent American. Wanda Urbanska hosts the TV show Simple Living. Her co-editor, Cecil Andrews, wrote the book Slow is Beautiful and is co-founder of the Finney Eco Village in Seattle. Wanda Urbanska, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's good to be here.
The title of your book is Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. And that lasting happiness is in bold there. That's last but not least.
Right. Well, you know, lasting happiness, it's funny that as you read that, I'm looking at my copy of Less is More as well. And lasting happiness, that's been the surprise to a lot of people who I think were sort of led to believe by the American system or taught to believe that the more we accumulate, the more money in the bank, the bigger our homes, those kinds of things, the happier we'll be. But in fact, there are a number of social scientists who have been studying these issues, and they have come to realize that actually more is not better. And what often happens in the battle for more, you know, the sort of one-upsmanship to get ahead in corporate America or to make more money, is that what falls by the wayside is the source of genuine happiness, which is relationships with each other. And in fact, if you want happiness rather than trying to get more money in the bank, you need to create more time in your life to just listen to your own inner voice, your intuition, and to cultivate relationships and healthy behaviors, you know, such as taking time to garden, taking time to say hello to people, taking time to not lead this frenzied, time-pressured lifestyle that so many of us have fallen victim to.
Well, talking about lasting happiness, you actually have an essay in the book, Less is More. In the essay, A Scientific Approach to Voluntary Simplicity, that shows that there's some research to back up some of your claims here. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Tim Kasser and Kirk Warren Brown.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Tim Kasser and Kirk Warren Brown studied exactly this question. I mean, if you have an intrinsically motivated sense of self, in other words, you're looking for what you truly want to do in life rather than taking what society, the script that society may hand you, you know, what are the repercussions? Well, what they find out is those who are not materialistically oriented tend to be happier. They tend to do more things for others, for the community. They even looked at children, and the children who are less materialistically oriented are more likely to turn off the light switches when they leave a room, for instance, to recycle an aluminum can that somebody may have tossed upon the walkway, to do things when other people aren't looking. And those folks are much more prone to healthy lifestyles and behaviors, not is likely to be involved with drugs or other unhealthy behaviors. So the scientific evidence is starting to mount that truly we have been sold a bill of goods about what, you know, what is a way to establish happiness, what is a way to establish security. It's not through building our bank accounts and getting more, you know, bigger houses and being less eco-friendly, but rather it's through those important bonds of community and also just learning who we are and what we want to do in this world.
Well, you said a bill of goods. In your essay, your introductory essay to the book, Less is More, you talk, Wanda Urbanska, about Simple Living's four tenets.
Mm-hmm.
Environmental stewardship, I think we can all pretty much understand that one.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughtful consumption, community involvement, which you've just touched on, and financial responsibility. Let's take this thoughtful consumption. Mm-hmm. What is thoughtful consumption?
Thoughtful consumption is a sort of a mindset. So many of us have, and Juliet Shore writes about this beautifully, that we as Americans have evolved from citizens into consumers, that we have been viewed as consumers who are put on this place on the earth not to be or to contribute, but rather to consume, to go out and buy. And what we've seen in this great recession of 2008 that we're still in the midst of is that what happens when people stop just automatically buying stuff? Well, I think that an upside to the downturn is that we are questioning the whole consumption model and turning in the direction of thoughtful consumption, which means you don't buy something every time a need arises. You look at alternative ways of sourcing. Let's say you're hanging up a light fixture in your wall. Well, you need an electric drill. Well, the old model of behavior is you run out to Lowe's or some big box store and you buy one. Maybe you end up using it, 15 minutes for a lifetime and it sits gathering dust for the next 30 years. The new model is you call up some friends, you send out a post on a social networking site, I want to borrow it. Or you, if you're in a progressive community or you happen to have created this, you start a tool sharing exchange where tools that are used infrequently are held in common. Or you maybe go out and rent this said item. And this paradigm is really rapidly expanding. There's a new term for these folks. They're called transumers, because what they realize is that the ownership of an item is not so essential, but rather the use of the item. And actually, they're freer. They're not burdened by the weight of all this stuff.
And they don't have to go out and buy to rent storage space and storage lockers to keep all the stuff.
Exactly. So, thoughtful consumption is an essential component of simple living, and I think people are really, really moving in that direction. And in terms of housing choices, we're seeing the trend, blessedly for the first time, it's starting to show up in 2007, of reduced housing size for new home construction, which had been increasing every year since the 1940s, while at the same time, family size was reducing. And time spent inside the house with, if husband and wife both out working was reducing. We were getting larger and larger houses. Well, that's changing. People are realizing that less is more. If we sort of ratchet it in, be more thoughtful about our possessions and what we bring in the house, we'll actually be freer.
And one of the contributors to your book, Less is More, is the person who wrote the...
Yes.
Not so big house.
Yes, Sarah Cizanka is a marvelous person, a good friend and colleague of mine, and she has really launched the not so big house movement. And actually, it's even the not so big movement. One of her more recent books was about the not so big life, and she very much is aligned with our thinking about bringing it down. I mean, living with in a smaller footprint, a smaller space, and really enhancing the quality of your life.
Now, you also, one of the essays, and it might have been yours, talks also about overcoming entitlement. So I wonder, entitlement, now that assumes a certain level of income.
Mm-hmm.
Is this just for the privileged few?
No, I really think the entitlement mentality has spread through our culture at really every different income level, from folks who, perhaps are really poor, who feel that somehow angry American society has promised us all these goods, and they see them on television, and why can't they have them? These goods will promise happiness to people. And I think it's also true at a very high income level. You can see it with all the greed as some of our financial institutions were collapsing, and the big guys were giving each other these multi-million-dollar bonuses, golden parachutes on the way out. Somehow, this notion that money is going to, first of all, that we're entitled to money, that it is our right to have all this money, and that money somehow is going to buffer us from the changes that are ahead of us. So I think the entitlement philosophy is all around us, and that one has to work hard to counteract that philosophy, even with children. I think oftentimes children, too, think that they have a right to everything. One of the things, I have a child who will be turning 12 tomorrow, and I have talked with other parents about things we can do to get those children working for us. One of my friends, she and I sat down to lunch one day, and we were saying, what's the difference between our kids who complain of boredom and the way we were raised at that age? And we realized that we were just working. You know, I worked for Mom, I cleaned up, I cooked, I gardened. And so we made a little pact that every time our child tells us, I'm bored, that means they get a chore. That means they're not working hard enough. So my son really does not complain about being bored. He has magically come to realize that he's got to find something to do, or else Mom's going to find a job for him. and actually, he does a lot of chores. He mows the lawn. We have a push mower. He rakes the leaves. He sweeps. He's just gotten used to it. And, you know, the thing that's interesting, he might gripe a little bit, but when he's completed a task, he feels good about himself. He has made a contribution to our home and the upkeep of our home. Well, now, mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of kids, teenagers, who just sit around the house. The lawn service comes and does everything, and I just don't think they are building, there's a building block to a stable work ethic in that individual.
Well, you know, most cultures, play is the imitation of adult work, if not mm-hmm. actually working along with adults. So, yeah. You know, you talk about time. You mm-hmm. mentioned some of this in the beginning, taking the time to say hello to somebody, but it's about more than that as well. Mm-hmm. There's a concept in one of the essays in your book, Wanda Urbanska, the book that you edited along with Cecile Andrews, Less is More, mm-hmm. And that's wabi-sabi time. This is a Japanese concept. Tell us what that is.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are three essays that really touch on foreign cultures, because I think a lot of simplicity always has spoken to me was taking wisdom from other cultures and introducing it into the American lifestyle. I know that I was very influenced. My father was born in Poland, and I had visited there many times from college to the present, and I was always struck by cultural differences. Wabi-sabi time certainly is inspired by Japan, a wonderful essay written by Robin Griggs Lawrence, the editor-in-chief of Natural Home Magazine, about that Japanese style of decorating and also just living with the tea ceremony that, of course, takes time. And in terms of how it translates into how we appoint our homes, it is counter to the notion of the cult of perfection, because wabi-sabi decorating looks at and treasures things that have age and imperfection. I mean, think a table that, you know, is 100 years old and has got nicks and signs of use and age on it, and that is treasured as opposed to something brand new right off the factory shelf. Another essay in the collection that has an influence from abroad is Alan Atkinson's essay about legume.
I loved that.
Didn't you love that?
I did. And so define, and I also took a lot of time to figure out, because he tells you how to pronounce it, and I think it goes legume.
Very good. You did much better than I did. But what that is there's a Swedish concept, and I think he says that there's not really another word for this. Well, there's certainly not one in English, but I don't know that there is one in any other language. But what it means is just enough. That what is enough? And he said you can use it for, you know, the atmosphere in a party. There's just enough. You don't want any more, or you don't want any more people. You don't want another plate of food out on a table. What you have is just enough. And that's the concept that we in Cecile and I, as we created the anthology Less is More, were attempting to help readers move in that direction. So what you look at is, yes, we have a challenge right now in our economy, but, you know, as Rahm Emanuel says, this is also a time for change. Don't waste an opportunity. If we seize this moment, we can really move our country in new directions, and I think it's already happening, and our hope is that the book will help people in making those changes.
And in talking about moving the country, you make clear in this anthology, Less is More, that it's not just an individual effort, that it's not the either-or, you know, either we change ourselves and society then changes, or society changes then we change ourselves, but that they have to go at the same time. You know, I loved Bill McKibben. He's been on our show a number of times.
Yes.
He talks in this book about a mature economy,
yes,
one which I think goes very much to the idea of the Danish word lagom, and calls into question the whole idea that we have to grow. Even the capitalism has to grow.
Right, exactly. Yes, that's a wonderful essay. I love that essay. And what he really shows us is that this idea that our economy needs unfettered, continued growth. Well, first of all, it's not sustainable. The environmentalists have been saying that for a long time. But it has been a politically untenable idea that you can't call for a slowdown in growth or just a keeping even. But in fact, he looks back at Franklin FDR, and he said that FDR felt that, you know, we were already at capacity economically and in manufacturing back in the 1930s. And so the idea is that we don't and we can't continue this model of continued growth. The earth can't sustain it. It's not good for our health and happiness, and we simply need to look for a new model. And certainly it can't happen globally. It can't happen. It can't continue in the U.S., and if you bring in China and India and all the economies that are on the rise, we'll really, really be even in deeper environmental trouble than we are today.
And I think a lot of people assume that without growth, you're not going to have prosperity.
Yes, they do assume that, but I think that instead of focusing on the old model of prosperity, what we need to be doing is developing, and we already are doing this, new modes of living. For instance, co-housing. Well, you don't need as many houses. You don't need as much square footage in houses. And let's continue finding homes, say, that can be redeveloped. Some new thinkers are out there figuring out ways to split up McMansions and make them into multifamily homes. Let's continue to push at the growth sectors like co-housing. And let's continue to work with urban redevelopment. These things are happening, and I think that what we should be encouraging in this new green economy, and certainly I think our new president is behind these initiatives, are these kinds of creative, adaptive reuses and new ways to look at economic growth or economic activity.
Well, Wanda Urbanska, you are the editor, along with Cecile Andrews, of Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and Lasting Happiness. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find links to Wanda Urbanska's Simple Living TV show at writersvoice.net. You can also read an excerpt from Terry Gould's book about Manik Saha. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.